House Committee on Business and Labor. And for those in the audience, we will be carrying House Bill 2405 over to Friday, when I intend, if I have the votes, to move it with the dash 9 amendments and send it to the floor. Okay, that's my hope anyway. Just so everyone knows exactly where I'm at on this. All the nice people out there. New grandparents, eh, tall? Okay. That's assuming I have the votes. We have the votes. Can I just go right down the line?
You can, yes, Mr. Chairman.
Is that good?
Yes, for those in Gelsinger.
Okay.
Yes,
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2528.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2528 allows the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to issue a special events license to a brewery public house licensee, otherwise known in common language as a brew pub. There is no revenue impact, and there's a minimal fiscal impact on the measure.
Okay, Representative Gelser. Please, is Representative Bailey.
We are preparing 2405.
Morning, Representative.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Representative Barton. It's an exciting morning indeed. Thank you very much for holding a hearing on House Bill 2528. Mr. Chair, I particularly wanted to thank you for holding this hearing. It is a bill about beer. I know that this can be a difficult issue sometimes. Last year, I was contacted by one of my local brewers, Dave Wills, who's here with me today, and he owns the Oregon Trail Brewery in my district, and he was very kind to introduce me to beer. I had never really purchased beer before, and he helped me do that. And while I was there, he brought to my attention...
I thought it was Barton who wasn't of age.
Oh no!
Just promise to help me. Don't worry.
Right. Okay. Let's now. The representative doesn't come here very often. Let's see how professional we can be.
But it is April 1st.
We can. Trying my best. Go ahead, Representative. Forgive me.
Thank you, colleagues. It's always a lot of fun when I come here. Anyway, Dave Willis, when I was there visiting his shop, he brought to my attention a concern about event licenses. Wineries have the option to obtain a special events license, and breweries do not. Breweries do have other temporary licensing options, but as this brewer has pointed out, it would be more fair if the special events winery license was opened to both wineries and brewers on the same playing field. So House Bill 2528, really simple, short bill that would accomplish this. And I brought my constituent, Dave Wills, with me to say a few words about why he requested this bill. And with your permission, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to him. And I thank you for holding this hearing. I urge your support.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Good morning, committee. Dave Wills with Oregon Trail Brewery in Corvallis. This is, I think, more kind of just a little housekeeping bill to kind of clean up something that probably should have been in the OLCC regs long ago, and so that's why I brought it up. And it's pretty much just a common sense thing to make it equal for breweries and wineries to be able to get the same event, special event permit. And I'm also here with a letter from the Oregon Brewers Guild. Ryan, from the executive director of the guild, was not able to attend, but I'll just read it quickly because it's just a few sentences here. It says, as you probably are aware, ORS 471.223 winery license and ORS 471.227 grower sales privilege license has allowed these licensees to obtain a special events license without obtaining a special temporary sales license, and with a nominal fee for up to 5 days to allow brewpub licensees to do the same would just make sense. So it's a pretty simple little thing. We hope we can amend it because it makes sense.
Thank you. Any questions of these good people? All right. Well, I made a comment earlier. We had a beer-related bill in here, and I said in politics, all babies are beautiful and all beer is good. Share that with you again today. All right.
Thank you.
We have everything it takes, all the paperwork. If we have the votes, I believe we'll just move the bill right now. Okay. Does anyone else want to thank you for coming? Anyone else?
I was just going to ask when this bill would take effect.
so I knew when to expect my
January
events.
January 1st.
There we go. Any further questions or comments to these good people? All right, thank you. Would anyone else like to testify on House Bill 2528 today? All right, seeing no one, I'm going to close the hearing. I'm going to open work session on House Bill 2528.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2528 to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2528 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Well, seeing none, so moved. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this wonderful bill on the floor?
I'll volunteer to carry it.
Oh, Kelser, would you like to carry the bill on the floor?
Oh, sure.
Well, there we go. So moved. Thank you for coming. I'm going to close the work session. House Bill 2528.
Mr. Chair, I can't believe the representative grew up in Corvallis and just now had her first beer.
She must not be a beaver.
That is a good one. She must not be a beaver. Oh, boy, I tell you. I know she ate a Hawkeye. She just had her first beer. Anyway, all right. I'm going to. That was a fun day. I wish they were all that way.
Yes,
okay, can I just go right down the line?
You can.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2200.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we first heard House Bill 2200 on February 11th. This is from the DCBS Building Codes Division. The measure synchronizes language between elevator safety standard statutes and boiler and pressure vessel safety standard statutes, modifies the fee schedules. It declares an emergency effective on July 1st, 2009. There is a current referral to Ways and Means on the measure, and you have in front of you a -3 amendment from the division, which corrects a Scrivener's error and also is a response to concerns and questions that were raised during and after the first hearing.
And I would appreciate it if our good friend Mark Long would come up here and just kind of, or if he'd like to bring his assistant or whoever, walk us through briefly what we're doing. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Mark Long, an administrator of State Building Codes, part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We, of course, did an overview of the bill during its original hearing. We have the -3 amendments that respond to stakeholder concerns. Specifically, we exempt the CO2 tanks altogether that are under 5 cubic feet. There was some discussion about that, otherwise known as beverage service tanks. And then over 5 cubic feet, we exempt them from periodic inspection. Under current law, without this bill, there are about 2,400 of these devices that are currently inspected by the division on a periodic basis. This would eliminate the periodic inspection of these devices and provide relief to about 600 businesses in Oregon. We develop a flat rate fee for the initial inspection of these devices over 5 cubic feet of $50. And then we change in the bill the groupings of the fees that, through stakeholder conversations, appeared to be too broad, and merge them back the way the statute currently is written. Representative Barton actually made that suggestion at the last committee hearing, and we took that suggestion and put it in. You should have before you, I assume, letters of support from the various groups that we worked with, including the Board of Boilers, who oversees the regulation enforcement of the boiler program with us. It's made up of contractors, workers, businesses, et cetera. And then you should have a letter signed by the various stakeholder groups that we worked with, including the Grocers Association and the Restaurant Association and other entities. With that, I'll be happy to answer any specific questions regarding the -3 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Well, I just want to start off by saying thank you, Mark. I know I may have caused some work for you personally, but that being said, I appreciate everything you've done to make sure it's squared away. It doesn't create some massive, huge amount of more inspections. I see there's no revenue impact, so therefore I know you're not going to be out dinging people because they got a compressor in their garage. Anyway, any Representative Cameron.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Long. Since our last visit, you just said there's no revenue impact. Is there?
I didn't want to correct the chair. There's actually a reduction of our revenue of about $83,000 over the biennium as a reduction in the periodic regulation of these devices. And you should have a fiscal.
Mr. Chair. Point out to the members, we do have a fiscal on the dash three. Yes, so the total with between the boiler program fees and the elevator program fees would be $924,564 for the 2009-11 biennium, and also for the same amount for the 11-13 biennium.
The dash three has reduced the original fiscal by about $83,000 as a reduction of the decreased regulation of these devices.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair, I just want to, because last, before these amendments, we were going from, we were going to raise $1 million in increased fees through this bill to have this program go forward. How much is that increased today?
None.
The dash threes don't increase. The original bill had a fiscal of roughly $1 million. I believe it was $940,000+. I can look here if you want to know specifics.
Close to it.
To give you some background on this, this program, the fees were set by the legislature in 1991. You can see those in the statute. The organization raised the fees in 2001, 10%. We've not increased fees since that time. So in roughly, 18, 19 years, fees have gone up 10%. The average overall increase across the board is somewhere between 30 and 35% for these devices. For some people, that's as little as $20, $30, $40 for a device. For others, depending upon the complexity of the equipment and how many devices they have, it could be higher. Hopefully that answers your question. The dash three amendments, Mr. Chair, again, because they reduce regulation, actually save, if you will, from the original fiscal impact, another roughly $83,000, I believe, by eliminating the CO2 tanks from periodic inspection.
And that is
and save 600 businesses from ongoing inspection of these devices, which currently they have to do now.
And that is because when you sat down and talked to these folks, you came to the conclusion that those inspections were not necessary. Is that correct?
That's correct. And we worked with our board, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, we worked with our board. I met, had numerous meetings with stakeholders, interest groups, to make sure that we didn't create a public safety concern and that this was appropriate level of adjusting the regulation. And everybody felt comfortable with that and bought off on it. And again, hopefully you have that documentation in front of you.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may, well, I think I got my question answered. So the original was $1,004,000, and now we're at $924,000 in increased revenues during the next, is that right? In the next biennium.
You're looking at the fiscal. I can dig it up here. That sounds about correct.
Okay.
Representative Cameron, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions of Mr. Long? All right. Thank you very much. Anyone else like to testify today on, well, we're in work session. Everybody's had their chance. Now that I asked, does anybody want to get up and talk about this bill? All right. I would entertain a motion to move the dash threes into the bill.
Chair, I move the dash three amendments to House Bill 2200.
Representative Holby moves dash three amendments into House Bill 2200. Is there any discussion? Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote affirmative to move the dash threes, but I will be a no vote on the bill based on the increase.
Any further questions, comments? Do we have to call the roll? Is anyone else opposed to the bill?
Well, clerk will just call.
Well, Representative Holby, did you have a comment?
No, Mr. Chair, not now.
Anyone else have any discussion?
Just, I anticipate the same thing as Representative Cameron.
Okay, that's fair.
And Mr. Chair, are you talking about just the dash threes now?
Yes,
or do you
ma'am.
Want the next thing?
Okay. Yes, Representative.
All right, then we'll pass.
All righty then. Well, clerk will call the roll then.
So on the dash three.
Are you on the dash three?
On the dash threes.
There are no objections.
No objections.
Oh, there's no objections. No objections to the
on the dash
threes.
Then so moved.
Yeah.
All right. I will entertain a motion to pass the bill. We have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means as amended.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2200 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Holy moves House Bill 2200 as amended to the floor due pass recommendation with subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, discussion, thank you.
Yes, sir.
I realize this bill's a fee increase, but I think as it was pointed out by the Building Codes Division is, you know, it's very, very important that we have ample inspections of these vessels for safety reasons, if nothing else. So, you know, I will be supporting this bill because of that very big issue. We don't want to see these pressure tanks blowing up. If you've ever seen one blow up, it's a pretty ugly sight.
Well, I definitely share your concern and your support, Representative. Our schools, hospitals, places of work, everywhere you go, if there's an industrial, commercial setting, these vessels it could just explode. We definitely need, and it's been made very clear, if we do not pass this bill and get the resources we need to carry out these inspections will not happen. And we will be sitting literally on a ticking time bomb, not a scenario I'm interested in being supportive of. Any further discussion?
Sure.
Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify what we did hear in previous testimony, that the revenues have not been there for these inspections to take place. However, they have continued to take place by the department becoming more efficient and using resources from other places that are not as high a priority, and I think that's a great example of what our government needs to do is to set priorities, and they have not endangered people in the state of Oregon, and by not passing this bill, I don't see that that would change anything. Thank you.
Thank you for your opinion, Representative. Any further discussion? All righty then. Well, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Fournier.
No.
Aye.
Representative Escobar.
No.
Vice Chair Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cameron.
No.
Representative Edwards.
No. April Fools.
You got it. Nice job. Nice job.
Nice job.
We have a party line vote.
Hi.
Okay, where are we at?
Representative Thatcher.
No.
And Representative Witt.
Aye.
All right, then. Thank the motion.
Chair
Chandler. Aye. The motion carries, and Chair will carry.
We don't have to do Carol.
I guess we don't have to do anything. We'll let one of those good ways and means people, if they see so fit to pass the floor, carry the bill. I'm going to close work session on House Bill 2200. We just go right down. That was a good one.
My motion was.
We can do this one for Monday. I think I can do it.
And for those in the audience, we are carrying over House Bill 2753 to Monday.
We'll do it for next week. I'll talk. The proponent knows. So yes.
We're waiting for a fiscal measure summary on that bill.
Yeah.
With that, we're just a public hearing on 3184.
Yep.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3184.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3184 allows insurance policies for the insured's funeral expenses to be entered into by family members, spouses, and persons financially responsible for the insured. The measure also waives the insured's consent requirements if the policy is entered into by family members and persons financially responsible for the insured. You have in front of you a dash to amendment that replaces the bill's language but not the intent of the bill.
Tamison?
Yes.
I need to know who I'm calling up here. Well, Representative Thatcher, why don't you come join us? And then we'll find out who's... we have some other nice people who want to talk to this bill, but Representative, if you want to call your constituent, I believe it is, up here. And let me see. And Mr... I'll call them up after these good people.
Okay.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Kim Thatcher, Representative from Kaiser. I have to look at my notes here. Where am I from? Kaiser, St. Paul and Newburgh. Good morning. Once again, this week I'm bringing you what I think is a simple bill. But in this case, it doesn't involve a simple issue for families. In fact, it can be a very difficult and emotional one. And we're talking about families who are trying to prepare ahead of time for when, not if, their elderly loved ones pass away. Under current Oregon law, if I wanted to go get funeral insurance for my grandma or whoever, I have to go get power of attorney just for that one purpose. And it seems a little overboard, and I'd say there should be an easier way. So my constituent, Dan Kohler from Kaiser, he came to me with a way to fix the problem. And many of you will probably agree most of the best ideas for legislation come from our constituents. Regular people come to us and say, hey, you know, there ought to be a law. And so after a few changes down at LC to get the language just right, that's the amendment that's before you. Dan is here to, today to tell you a little bit about the bill and ask for your support.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler. Members of the committee, my name is Dan Kohler. I have a business based in Kaiser. I assist funeral homes by providing marketing and products for the purpose of pre-planning funerals. Currently, I'm working with about 30 funeral homes in Oregon, and probably, more than likely, working with a funeral home in your hometown. My agency assists well over 100 families a month in putting these plans together. Determining what ceremonies and services should be, and I am a licensed funeral director and embalmer and a licensed insurance agent. I saw a need to propose this legislation because so many people I saw were required to get a POA just for this specific purpose, or were tempted to forge documents in order to get around the requirement. Many of those were people that have just been placed in a nursing home and their son or daughter or other family member was trying to take care of these things. I brought this to Representative Thatcher, and she encouraged me to bring some suggestions, which I did, and I'd like to publicly thank her and her staff for her bringing this forward for me. Why do I think we need a change? I have a couple of stories, just one real quick, unless you want more.
So what'll be
okay. One of my agents was working with a mother of a ward of the state. The young man had been mentally handicapped and grew up in their home, but then was in group homes and institutions prior or after that. His mother was putting her own plan together and wanted to provide for her son also, but because of the current statute, she didn't have the insurable interest or the ability because she didn't have the right to sign the plan. It took a whole bunch of 3 weeks to get it. She couldn't get a power of attorney because he was a ward of the state. This law would make that possible for her to put together and provide for her son. Many other stories, but in a nutshell, it just makes it easier for the people. I would like your support. Is there any questions that you have?
I just want to thank you and the good representative for bringing the bill. Certainly we want to make people in these time of need as little grief as possible. So I just want to thank you. It's very sensitive of you, and I agree with you. Any questions of these good people? Representative Escobar.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. One question. Does anyone know why we have to have a power of attorney if I assume that responsibility? I guess I'm not connecting the dots there. If I came to you and said, I'll pay for this, or I'll be responsible for it, or, you know, whatever, why would I need a power of attorney? I mean, there must have been a reason for that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquil, the insurance code is different than the funeral division code. And you can pay for a funeral, but in order to pay for it with an insurance policy, you're required to have either insurable interest or meet one of these exceptions. I think originally it was put together so that if you didn't like your mom or dad, that you didn't put out a great big policy on her and offer.
Oh, I never thought of that.
That would be my guess.
Representative Kenner.
Representative, you have -2 amendments. Who did you work with on those, if I may ask? Or
I am not the expert on this subject matter.
So we're going to be
because there are some interesting issues about we need to be sure. And as far as I can read them, it appears that this really limits it to immediate members of the family, and rather than an effort to secure insurance on unrelated individuals, which and we is posed with lots of problems.
We are going to be hearing about the Dash 2 amendment shortly, but if you'd like to answer the question.
Well, maybe if there's someone else that can testify with expertise, that'd be fine. I just want to make sure we get it.
It is a good question. Do you want me to address it?
If you wish, go right ahead.
My understanding, now, if I understand the question properly, Mr. Chair, Representative, could you repeat just the question specifically?
I think the point of the original bill was that it was cut broadly enough that perhaps you could insure individuals that were not relatives, and that poses possibilities for some. Some interesting possibilities where you could get insurance on people, and there have been instances where people are killed to claim that insurance on, like, for example, homeless individuals, and very inappropriate use of insurance. Always tied specifically to blood relatives to make sure that that's not the case. And I think I made it, and I think we're going to have some testimony. I see somebody nodding their head in the back that understands this. So that's what I needed to know.
And we're also going to hear that is already illegal anyway, that scenario. So.
That's my understanding.
All right. Any further questions of these good people today?
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. I'm going to call John Brenneman, John Mangan. Up, please. And would you guys please speak to Representative Kennerman's questions and comments, too, please? Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Excuse me. For the record, my name is John Mangan, and I'm Regional Vice President for the American Council of Life Insurers. So we represent life insurance companies that sell the policies, 95% of the policies sold in the state. And I do want to thank the sponsor and the author for working with us on a couple of concerns we did point out in the original draft. And I think our concern was more that, again, the bill was cut too broadly than what was really intended, I think. I want to say that the Section 2 of the bill, the language that was inserted by the sponsor, is acceptable to us and looks fine. I think it's important to look at Section 2 as a consent provision. That's what it really is. It says that you need consent in general to cover somebody, even if they're a spouse or even if they're related. There are some exceptions, and this new exception is going to take care, I believe, of the sponsor's concern about parents in a nursing home or those situations. But the first section was the one that our industry is really concerned about, and I think we wanted to raise the issue that Representative Kennemer just mentioned, and that is the insurable interest statute. And this is the statute that really is the core of our products, the core of our industry. It's what tells us what is acceptable when you procure insurance. And so we get very nervous when this is opened up. We know that it's been subject to abuse over time. And so we were very careful, of course, about not tinkering with this section if it's not necessary. And all I would say on this one is that the draft does add a new exemption. You can see it in line 7. It says, however, except as provided in ORS 743027, that's the consent provision, you can't procure insurance under these, you know, unless you have this insurable interest. And I think this is, frankly, a drafting error. I don't think you're trying to make an exemption from insurable interest. You're just making it an exemption from the consent requirement in Section 2. So although, again, we're fine with the bill and the concept, I would strongly urge that you'd have Ledge Council take another look at that exemption that's been added in line 7. And I hate to do that to you, Representative, but I think it's important enough a definition that you really don't want to open it up in this way. So that's... be happy to answer any questions.
Before I move on to John, let me be clear. The Dash 2s don't address your concerns. Have you read the amendment, the Dash 2 amendment?
Yes, I have it right here, Chairman.
And then you're requesting that we need to do a little more than that. Am I hearing you right?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just saying that the Dash 2 is acceptable in the Section 2 change. This is Section 2 of the bill as amended. The exemption added in Section 1 is, we believe, unnecessary and opens up an ambiguity. What you're saying there is that you need an exemption from insurable interest to cover people that are blood relatives, and that's just not true. So I think if you took out the words, this 743.027 or, just returned it to its original condition, we'd have absolutely no problem with this.
All right. Then I would request that you work with Mr. Kohler and a good representative and Mr. Brenneman. And I think, obviously, the intention of this bill is, I'm very sympathetic to it, and I think you have a good idea. I want to make sure we get everything squared away, and you all get together after this, and I'm sure you can figure it out. John, you have something to add today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Brenneman. I represent the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. Mr. Kohler is an associate member of the funeral directors. This bill is one that he has brought forward on his own. The Oregon Funeral Directors Association operate a pre-need trust, which is another form of taking care of arrangements. But we think that changes in the law provided in House Bill 3184 and the concepts are good. It's another tool our members can use in their work, and we support 3184. And if the bill needs some further refinements, that's fine too.
Okay, John, I would request that you sit down with these folks too.
Okay.
And, you know how this process works as good as anybody in the building, and just kind of work it out for us. Any questions or comments to these gentlemen? Is that fair, Representative Thatcher?
Yes.
All right, thank you very much. All right, guys, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
And we anticipate your coming back with language that we can all easily support. Thank you very much. It's an important concept. I think we can get from there from here. And I'm going to close the public hearing of House Bill 3184 and open the public hearing of House Bill 2778.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2778 requires the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to adopt a process for identifying entry-level and light-duty assignments for injured state workers. There is an emergency clause on the measure effective upon passage. The measure and the Dash 1 amendment, which I'll explain to you shortly, was approved by MLAC at the hearing on March 13th. The Dash 1 amendment corrects a Scrivener's error in Section 2 of the original bill regarding the correct provision pertaining to state agencies. It clarifies that the administrator of the DAS's personal division must adopt by rule the process and as an effective date of July 1st, 2009 instead of the emergency clause.
Thank you. Teresa, Mark Rasmussen and Mary Botkin, please. Whoever wants to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. And this bill was introduced at our request. It culminates sort of a frustrating decade of work on our part. And let me just give you sort of a quick and dirty background. When the Mahonia Hall reforms for workers' comp were done, there was a significant change made in the way the state's workers' comp rates were configured and calculated. That change created an environment where the state, for the purposes of setting workers' comp rates, was considered to be a single employer. What that did was it allowed high injury agencies to be offset by lower injury agencies and mitigated the impact on individual agencies with high workers' comp rates. It made an incredible amount of sense. We supported those changes. In our understanding of how that would be carried forward, the state would be considered one employer also for the purposes of returning injured workers to work. So that in theory, if you worked for the Department of Corrections or the Department of Transportation and you were injured on the job and you were unable to return to your former employment or to your job at injury, that you would have available to you vacant positions statewide in any state agency regardless. And providing that you could qualify for the job and providing that the job was open, you couldn't displace current people, but you would have some preference in getting those jobs. That, in fact, never came to pass. And, in fact, we had any number of excuses or reasons given to us why injured workers who were injured in one state agency could not be returned to work in another state agency. Sort of everybody was blamed and nobody accepted the responsibility for the problem. Now, we experienced the problem most focused in the Department of Corrections, where we had officers who were injured in inmate attacks and were unable to return to the prison environment for any number of reasons. And in at least two of the most severe cases that I know of, officers actually got termination notices at their homes prior to getting a full medical release. Now, you know, we can talk about whether there was a mistake. We can talk about anything. What doesn't matter is that this created a huge trauma for people and sort of dampened the confidence that people had in their employer. So we have introduced legislation to correct this problem a couple of times. Both times in the past there was a fiscal impact on it. I think this year we finally got it right. There is no fiscal impact anymore because both in the previous times the bills died in Ways and Means.
Mary, it says minimal, just so you know, minimal.
Okay. Now, something significant has changed in the last year to 18 months, and the gentleman sitting next to me, Mark Rasmussen, is what has changed. Mr. Rasmussen actually has written rules that does everything we want to have done. We're actually doing what we thought we should be doing for the last decade. And I appreciate the fact that Mr. Rasmussen did this, sort of took a look at the situation and said this is the right thing to do, wrote rules to do it. Now, one might ask why we still want a bill, and I will be very honest with you. I trust Mark Rasmussen. I have no idea who's going to replace Mark Rasmussen when he finds a better job, because he will find at some point a better job. And when he leaves the Department of Administrative Services, I don't want some knuckle-dragging Neanderthal to take his place and undo the rules that we have now.
And we shouldn't talk about the chair of this committee in that way.
I sincerely hope that is not your career goal. If it is, we need to chat. But seriously, this bill is meant to do now is to memorialize actually what Mr. Rasmussen has put in place by rule, and hopefully we can sort of stop the finger pointing. I mean, at one point they blamed the unions for not putting people back to work, and I finally, last session, you all will remember, I testified and I said, you know, I really don't give a rip whether they wear purple shirts, green shirts, blue shirts, or no shirts. You know, when somebody's injured and they're ready to return to work, we need to find them a job. And I operate on the premise that you do the right thing, and if you always do the right thing by a person, then eventually it all works out and everything balances off in the end. And I still feel that way. I don't care if one of our members has to go to work in an OPEU unit or one of their members needs to come over and work in one of our units. If they're ready to return to work and they've been injured, we're going to find them a job. That's what we should do. Thank you.
And, you know, you brought that one gentleman with you who'd lost his house, got divorced. God knows where he's at now, and I wish him well if he's watching.
Actually, Dave Schatz was the individual that we brought in last session, and it took us, almost a year and a half to find Mr. Schatz. He had a college degree, had been injured by inmate attacks on three separate
Mary,
occasions.
Mary, let me interject. Guys, we are going to be working this bill today, so don't go too far. Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Bakken.
This man just literally got kicked to the curb, got a termination notice from the employer at a point where he thought he was going to be able to return to work. His doctor said he could only return to work if he had limited inmate contact. That was a death sentence for him in his career. And we could not find him alternative employment. And it took us a long time, and a lot of political chits were cashed in order to find Mr. Schatz a position within the Department of Corrections that he could do. In the meantime, he lost his home, his wife left him, he lost custody of his children.
Is he on his feet now?
He is, you know, I always think that no news is good news, and Mr. Schatz told me that he got a job as a counselor in the corrections division, and I have not heard a word since, so I assume that all things are good with Mr. Schatz.
If you run into him, tell him we send him.
Yes. So this is sort of the Dave Schatz Memorial Bill, but it really is an important piece of legislation for a small group of people.
Right. Well, and we want every worker working who wants to work. Mr. Asmussen, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Rasmussen. I'm with the Department of Administrative Services, Human Resource Services Division. I'd like to, and what I've submitted in written testimony is some description about what our current policies are, what we have put in place, which Mary has spoken to. The actions that we will implement if the bill passes, and you know, also want to seek any clarification that we about what we're doing to make sure that we're consistent with the intent of the legislature in passing this bill. So I won't go through, obviously it's quite lengthy materials in terms of what our current policies are, but essentially the philosophy is to allow injured workers to come back to light duty employment when they're recuperating from their injuries, get them back as soon as possible to do that, and then once they are released if they have permanent restrictions from that injury, try to bring them back to their job at injury. That's what most of them want to do, return to that particular job either with accommodation or without accommodation if it's not needed. In some limited instances, people aren't able to come back no matter what we do, aren't able to do that same job. And in those instances, what we're doing is what Mary is talking about, is making sure that we've looked everywhere within the state, that every opening is looked at first for that person that they qualify for, and we'll put them in that job. Now, they don't get promoted out of that through that process. It's either equal or within a reasonable level below what they were making. So that is the essence of our policies. It does cross agency lines. We have been doing that. It's been effective. We've only had a few people on those lists, cross-agency injured worker list, you know, at a time, but most of those people are moving through. We've had some success stories around that in the past couple of years, and I don't think we've run into any major problems so far. That doesn't guarantee that we won't. These things are difficult to manage. It's never good when someone is injured at work. It's obviously never good when they can no longer do their line of work based on those injuries, but that's sometimes the reality that we deal with. I thank Mary for the recognition of what we've done, but it's not just about me. It's about my department and the direction that they've given me, their understanding of the legal requirements that we have that have been set out. I also understand that the past has not been good, and that there are concerns from the unions, there are concerns from affected workers, and they want to make sure that we continue to do what we're doing now. And that's what I understand the intent of this bill is. And I think we've, through some of the amendments, although I haven't seen them in final form, I understand that we've got it worked out so that it just affects the executive branch of state government, and it's what we will do is implement a temporary rule to coincide with the effective date of the legislation that will basically take the policies that we put in place, which is an internal management directive, and make that an Oregon administrative rule. So it's a little more permanent in nature.
Great. Mr. Chair, and I did not comment on the fact that we were trying to include the judicial branch as well. And I just felt that, you know, any corrections officer injured on the job was capable of being a judge, but Mark encouraged me they couldn't, so.
Right. Well, you know, I just want to thank you both for your efforts, and I think every worker that wants to work, we should help them get them to work, and if someone who's injured through no fault of their own, the effort and the expense going toward finding them a job is well worth it. It's either that or they can go on welfare and cost us more money, and God knows what could happen. So I really appreciate efforts. And as far as memorializing statute, Mary, I could not agree more. I'm wildly sympathetic to this concept, and you're exactly right. We cannot leave it to the hands of those. We cannot predict the future, and I want to make damn sure that this concept, this idea, is carried out to the letter. And I appreciate you, Mr. Rasmussen, your efforts. Any questions of these good? Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I think I'm going to probably repeat what I said 2 years ago. I am dumbfounded that government has finally caught up with the private sector. And it's taken this long, because back in the 70s, we did this very thing in the private sector. It's just a no-brainer. And the other thing it does, it decreases your insurance factor greatly, which in turn you're actually gaining an economic advantage. So I congratulate government for making a major breakthrough 30 years after the fact.
Thank you, Representative. As always, it's very welcome. Your words are welcomed, and the wheels of government grind on slowly. Representative Edwards and Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this. I'm fully supportive. I think we really need to do this. I do have a couple of questions. You said... In getting a return to work program, if you place, say, a corrections officer in a different agency, is that with the intent of stepping up back into their old job always, how is that worked out? Because I could see where, in some instances, and not in Mr. Schott's instance, but in some instances, if the goal is to get back into their previous job, does that mean they have to step outside of that agency, go into another agency just temporarily for 6 months, and then come back into the existing agency?
I think it depends on their injury and the recovery process. For Mr. Schott, it became very clear to us that Mr. Schott had become a target of the inmates, and
right.
that he was not going to be able to work in an environment where he had ongoing contact with inmates. And so we needed to figure out some other alternatives for him. Unfortunately, what we didn't have, what Mark and I did not have available to us, was the ability to compel the Department of Transportation, for example, in saying, we have five opportunities over here that Mr. Schott could do, and move him across agency lines and force them to give him some sort of, quote, super consideration. And I think that we've broken those barriers down now. And that was just a challenge for all of us in trying to figure out a way to sort of move people. When somebody has an opportunity to go back to their original position, then it would be our preference, and we'll work through this with DAS, is our preference would be to find a light-duty position within the department that they're going to go back to work in while they complete their recovery.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I think one of the important distinctions is when that worker is injured, if there's a temporary reassignment while they're in recovering from those injuries, they could move between work units, between agencies, and still get back to their original job. It wouldn't be a permanent movement. When we're looking at a permanent placement with a worker who's been deemed by their attending physician as this person can no longer do this work, you simply can't do this anymore, then we're forced to look at a permanent reassignment, and that may, in the instance of a correctional officer, say, you're going to drive a truck, and we're not intending you to go back to the facility and do the work that you did before.
Representative Edwards?
Yeah, thank you. So, say you have a state hospital worker, and they want to return to their job, and that's injured. They want to return to their job. They could return to their job, but they need a temporary reassignment for early return to work purposes. And they get put in, I don't know, whatever, the state parks department. I'm just picking an agency. Are there agencies that tend to be heavy on or heavily skewed toward positions that are going to lend themselves to light duty return to work? And if we have enough agencies that are all dumping their employees, their return to work folks, into those, you know, just one or two areas, they're never able to kind of get the longevity of employees that they're looking for, because they're always filling those positions by, and maybe that's just a hypothetical that actually doesn't exist. I'm just asking if it does exist from an HR perspective.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Edwards, I think there's some agencies are quite large and will end up, by virtue of that, receiving more permanent placements of injured workers. It might be influenced a little bit by the type of work that they do. The Department of Human Services has been in receipt of quite a few injured workers. They've been wonderful in accepting those people, but other agencies have as well. So I think it's proportionate to the size of the agency. It's probably influenced a little bit by the type of work, but there's so many state agencies doing so much variance of work, and in almost all agencies there's some form of light duty that either can be done on a temporary basis or a permanent basis. So there's usually quite a few options. Sometimes we're limited based on individuals. Work restrictions that are very stringent in a geographic area that's remote, so there's not a lot of agencies, not a lot of positions, and that's when our options become limited. They might have to choose to move to go to a different agency, to a different line of work in those instances.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher, then Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just can't help but comment and echo some of the comments made by Representative Esquivel. I'm absolutely flabbergasted. The state had no incentive or reason to get people back to work prior to you being there, of course, Mr. Rasmussen. I just find it shocking that this hasn't been happening already. So, well, prior to you being there, of course, Mr. Rasmussen. So, anyway, I just think this bill makes a lot of sense.
Mr. Chair, I do have to say that literally life changed with Mr. Rasmussen. I mean, it really did. I mean, we went from a just say no scenario to a we're going to make this happen scenario. And it has been night and day for us as a union in working with him.
And I got to tell you, it's just pathetic. Mm-hmm. It really is pathetic. And I'm a supporter of public service. I think government has a great, valuable role to play in our community. But this kind of thing that really makes our jobs up here all the more difficult, and I can't express my gratitude enough to you, sir.
Representative Thatcher, are you finished?
I am finished.
Okay, thank you for your words, and I agree. Representative Matthews, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very supportive of this bill, too, and this concept, and I appreciate your work, Mr. Rasmussen. What a difference a day makes, or, you know, hiring the right person into a job that understands the situation. But I have a couple questions, I think, just so that I'm clear. And don't take this as being anybody opposed to this bill, because I'm very supportive. Understanding the expense that goes into hiring people. I know you're putting forth the effort to find and place people, but also, you know, the expense and resources to hire somebody. But my questions are in terms of the bargaining unit contracts. You had mentioned, you know, you could transfer out of one, essentially one bargaining unit into another. Have you had some discussions, or is there something you can enlighten us on in terms of, because we're talking about compensable injuries, and we're also no intent to displace workers. Are there bumping rights in these contracts, and could that be, and I'm just asking because I think we need to know. So are there bumping rights within the contracts? Could we potentially displace somebody? And the seniority issue is something that's going to be within your bargaining unit. That's not my concern. But I'm concerned about the bumping rights and how that would happen.
I do not believe that that is an insurmountable problem. I believe that as those challenges emerge, and they have not at this point, that reasonable people will come to reasonable solutions. And I think it is, in talking with some of my colleagues in other unions, I believe that everybody has the same intent, and that is to get these folks back to work and to not further victimize folks who've been victimized by an on-the-job injury. And I think I believe that there are not insurmountable problems between bargaining units. If that sounds like a whooshy answer, it's whooshy because I don't know what the bargaining language, I don't know what the language is
in another contract. Let's hear from the department on that.
Well,
we'll follow up, your representative. Believe me, I'm following up on it too. Go ahead.
Chair Schuffler, Representative Matthews, we have looked at this issue with our labor relations managers within Department of Administrative Services. We're really looking at vacant positions when we're looking at permanent placements. So we're not bumping an existing employee out of their job in order to accommodate an injured worker. So that gets us away from the most obvious issues of violating someone else's contractual rights to their job. There may be some potential challenges with the filling of vacancy language in some collective bargaining agreements. We have not had that yet. We've been doing this for over 2 years, and we haven't had a challenge yet on that. So we haven't had any question about it. So,
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and follow up. Specifically to AFSCME, then, would there be a bumping right within AFSCME contract if they were AFSCME employee in one particular? I appreciate what you're saying about vacancies, and I appreciate the tenure and what it takes and the cost of training and everything else. I just really want to get a grip on, if somebody was injured, do they have the right to bump somebody below out of that position, or are we looking at vacant positions? Is that what we're talking about?
Vacant positions.
Okay, or next available vacant positions.
Yes.
Okay, correct. No, that's fine.
Suitable and available.
And I just want to, and I really appreciate that question. So I'm not interested in taking one person out of work and putting another person out of work. Then before I go to Ms. Representative Witt and then Kenemer, in the bumping arena, if the person isn't injured, can they bump somebody anyway? So you wouldn't really be creating... Anyway, just forget about it. Don't even ask the question. But I want to stress this. I do not want that scenario happening. And if it is happening in the next 2 years, we're going to be right back here addressing it. So I strongly encourage you all. I don't even want to hear one example of that happening. So, and that's a high bar, but I think I'm confident you can do it, or we will be back here amending this part of the statute. Representative Witt, then Kenemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to comment that the need for this bill points up a problem, as I think several of the committee members already have. But I really wish that we would, as governments, start asking the question before we erect barriers. If we put a barrier up, is that good government? And clearly this is not good government. As Mary pointed out, we've had 20 years worth of experience in this state in workers' compensation reform. We are supposedly the model for the rest of the nation in terms of how to handle workers' compensation claims. Clearly, from both a labor and a management position, it pays to get that worker back to work as soon as you possibly can. And for the state to have erected a barrier such as this is intolerable. And I don't know, Mr. Chairman. I don't know how you begin to deliver that common sense. Is this good government or not when we do things? Enough said. Thank you.
Well, I share your I see the common sense on a broad range of issues within the statute. Representative Kenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Representative Matthews' point. I think sometimes we get in trouble on unintended consequences. Mr. Rasmussen, I wonder, what would you think about amending this bill so that it specifies vacant positions? Because I foresee we're likely to have a challenge on this issue, and why don't we just clarify what our intention is? We're specifying this is what we shall do. Why don't we just make it clear how that's going to be done so we don't run into the bumping problem?
Before you answer the question, the chair's intention is to work the bill today. If we want to come back and revisit this issue within this session, that's fine. Another bill or something, but I intend to move this bill today. And if we're assuming we have the votes, then once again, I share Representative Kenner and Representative Matthews' concern. And if it does come back, we are going to change it. And if there's just one case, I'll be very disappointed. So I think he makes sense, but there's a time to talk and a time to vote, and we're running out of time, and we're going to move this bill assuming we have the votes. But I do agree with him completely in his concern. So I don't know if that's... But go ahead and respond to the good representative's question, if you wish.
Just ought to be done here.
Okay. Chair Schaffler, Representative Kenner, I think we're there in terms of dealing with permanent placements on vacant positions only. And we're not intending either through our policies or our rules or processes to bump anyone out of a job. I would appreciate the clarification. I don't know that it's necessary in the statute, and I don't think, based on what the committee wants to do today, if you're going to move the bill, you'll move the bill.
I want to move the bill, assuming I have the votes, and it still has to go through the Senate process, and I believe it'll go to Senator Rosenbaum. And Ms. Botkin, I really think it should be addressed. I think it would be...
I would be happy to work with Mr. Rasmussen.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a great bill, and I'll echo a lot of the things that have already been said, but I want to just clarify the concern. I know as a private employer, we do everything we can to get somebody back to work, and I can think of no time where I've ever taken a good employee's job away to put an injured worker. What we will do is we'll almost create work for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, we will find something for them to do to get them back on the team as quick as possible so they feel like they're a part of the team and they can be productive work people. The other comment I'll make is that there's a minimal fiscal impact statement on this. I can't imagine that this is not a positive thing for our state from a standpoint of efficiency, and the only thing I can think of that we're sitting here talking about today is that nobody's accountable for signing the workers' comp bill for the state, so nobody cares, and it's a good policy, and I'm with you, and we need to move the bill, and I echo the concerns. I would expect no good employees are going to get kicked out of their jobs because we're trying to help somebody else get back to work.
I can't imagine.
We just can't lose focus. What we're trying to do is to stop the practice of state agencies kicking folks to the curb and saying, you're used meat. We're done with you.
Yeah.
Well, no more of that.
And who's paying the bill for the used meat?
Yeah. Well, all of us.
The taxpayers.
Yeah.
And nobody's accountable for signing that check.
And the injured worker and their families.
And we are going to hold them accountable right now unless there's further comments or questions of these good people. And I put Ms. Representative Kenner.
I just want to object to the process. I think when we find a clear flaw, we have to fix it. It would only mean, could be put up next, Friday, and we could, I think there's unanimous support is the way I read it here. I just don't see why we don't fix the flaw if it's there, and why, I mean, we see unintended consequences. I'm not sure. I can't imagine when Mahonia Hall was meeting that they thought that displaced workers would be screwed.
That's the problem.
And I just think, why don't we fix it and send it on?
Representative, why we have the smartest person in the room sitting just to the right of me, the amendment would have to go all the way through the major management labor advisory committee process again. Yeah,
and Mr. Chow, point out that they meet every other week, and so I believe the next meeting, they're meeting this Friday, so it would be mid-month. And so between the amendment and us waiting to process the amendment after the MLAC meeting, there would be the possible risk of the bill not meeting the
timeframes. How do you get it to that committee?
Well, which leads me to this. We will draw up the amendment language, send it to MLAC. In the meantime, we will send this to the floor, send it to Senator Rosenbaum, and in that period of time, I believe the MLAC committee can address, and then when it comes back to concur, Representative, you'll have a chance to vote on concurrence. I'm hoping that, praying to God, we can, but I'm moving this bill today, assuming we have it. I share your concern. I just want to make that very clear.
I appreciate your following the process,
very good.
And I'll be happy with it.
Very good. All right, Dan. Any further questions or comments to these good people? Representative Whip.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out that there are, in the majority of these jobs, I believe, labor contracts that are in place that would describe when somebody, when there is a vacant position, when someone has a job that essentially they could not be bumped out of. I also believe that, and I can't remember the statute, but 656 also discusses open and available jobs that people would be returning to. So I actually think a lot of our concerns here are already addressed.
Yes, please. Okay. And you know what? That may well be the case, Representative, and I hope you're right. Any further comments or questions before I entertain a motion? We're in public hearing, right?
Yes.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank
Good
you,
bill
sir.
Should pass. Urge your vote. I'm going to close public hearing, House Bill 2778, open work session, House Bill 2778.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash ones to House Bill 2778.
Representative Cameron moves dash one amendment to House Bill 2778. Discussion? Any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2778 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2778 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? And I share the concerns here, and I believe, and I've asked Ms. Van Winkle to have Legislative Council draft that if necessary. If not necessary, we'll hear about that. If necessary, and then get the whole MLAC process going before the end of the session, long before, I believe we can address our concerns and pass it. I believe this bill will become the law. So, without any further comment or discussion, is there any opposition to the motion? All right, seeing none, so moved. Would anyone like to represent Whit? Would you like to carry this bill on forward?
Thank you very much.
All right, I believe that completes our agenda. Anything for the good of the order? All right, we're adjourned.